He says, you know, be ready. So that was it. And that happened two or three times. I think the last time I said, no, I don't need to come over.
Just tell me on the phone.
Tell me what your decision is.
One of the things that I was always surprised about is that he got such good performances, and a part of that had to be because of the talent, out of his players. Did he motivate by fear to some degree?
He just had the look. He never yelled. You just knew that you wanted to play for him. He's one of the few people I've ever known in my lifetime that what he stood for and what he represented and what he was exactly who he was. He didn't vary from it. He was a Christian man that walked the line. He was just a phenomenal person that didn't vary one bit. He was just a tremendous man, just something that you have to admire and I look to all the time.
I would assume that knowing Roger Staubach's background with the military academy and everything, having been to Vietnam before he joined the Dallas right. Cowboys, that he was probably pretty comfortable with that because he had come out of that environment at Annapolis. Am I
yes.
correct in that assumption?
Well, he and Coach had their problems too. I probably got along with him better than Roger did. But everybody loved Coach Landry. When Roger came, I just thought it was amazing because I played against him in college. And we were in some all-star games together. Phenomenal talent, but just I think he was in the Navy for 3 years, and then he joined us. And phenomenal competitor. He always made things happen. So, and I love him to death. He's one of my best friends. He's one of the guys that I've always counted on. He's always been there. So all my teammates that I've been with, these great teams, have been really great friendships throughout your lifetime because you've been through so many things with them. And I guess that happens to anything, but I played on some really great teams that won a lot of championships, and maybe that makes you closer.
Tell me about Super Bowl V.
Super Bowl V was like, I don't know, a joke. everything that was like the follies of football happening. Tip passes, going through people's hands into John Mackey's hands, and he runs through everybody for 88 yards. Dwayne Thomas fumbles in the 1 foot line. As we're going in, probably win the game. Dave Manders falls on it, but in those days they did not unpile. They just did what the referees saw is what they were going to call. So the refs came up saying it's Baltimore's ball, and of course Baltimore's pointing it's their ball. And I ran up to the ref. I said, wait till they get off the ball. And I was probably using bad language. He says, you say another word, you're out of the game. Come on. And I said, come on, make them get off the ball. And sure enough, Dave Manders stands up and hands him the ball, but they gave it to Baltimore. And then we're third and – I remember this very well. We're third and 14 or something, and I'm off of the sideline conferring with Coach Landry. I said, Coach, let's play for overtime. And he said, no, let's go with this play. And he wanted me to roll out to the right, and Danny Reeves was curling into the zone. So I threw it to Danny, and it went through his hands into Mike Curtis's hands. They called timeout, kicked a field goal. The game was over. Like 30 seconds, and we're standing there. Wait a minute, the game's over. We're just gonna win this game, and it just ended like that. And it's something I will never get over.
No, I can understand. It was one of the early Super Bowls. I covered Super Bowl IV was my first, and Super Bowl V was the second one. And I remember that game. It was down in Miami, was
right.
it not? Yeah. Tell me about Super Bowl XII when you were the quarterback in Denver.
Well, we had a great year, a miraculous year, because nobody expected Denver to do anything. We came in and we went to the Super Bowl, beat Oakland in the playoffs to go, and they're the defending champion. We just did not match up well against Dallas's front four. We usually played a 3-4 teams. We didn't play very many 4-3s. Dallas knew our weaknesses, and they blitzed the heck out of me and made me look like a fool. I just remember counting those tiles in the Superdome's ceiling. I couldn't get high enough because that's all I was on my back. So it was a very disappointing game. I played very, very badly. Our team played badly. Our defense played well, but our offense just gave the ball game away the whole game. And I always hate when Super Bowl comes around because that's the game that – if I'm watching Super Bowl highlights, please, I've never seen that game. I'm not going to ever watch the game. I can forget that game. Super Bowl V, I like to remember. Super Bowl XII, horrible. And I think it's the worst, they've always voted, or that the worst performance by a quarterback ever was my performance in Super Bowl XII. So it's not something that's really, I want to just relive.
But when you think of the hoopla around the Super Bowl today and compare it to those early days. I always tell the story. My first one was Super Bowl IV down in Miami, and they begged me to come to the commissioner's party and asked me how many tickets I wanted to buy at $25 a piece.
Now you're lucky to get in for $1,500.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. I mean, what was it like? What was the hoopla
well,
like?
Well, one of the great I remember Super Bowl V again. We're in Miami, and we're kind of walking through the tunnel, and I look up, and there's two huge balloons. One is of Johnny Unitas, who was my hero. I mean, this here I'm playing against Johnny Unitas, and he was my hero a few, you know, number of years ago. And the other one is of me. And I'm looking at it, and I said, this is a dream that a young kid could never possibly ever see. Of course, now it's just, that was Super Bowl V, so, you know, times 30 now, or whatever we are, 40? Super Bowl 47.
Now there's a lot of them.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But now, holy mackerel, the halftime entertainment, everything that goes on, it's hard to even know if there's a football game.
I want to make an observation here, and if I'm wrong, feel free to correct me on it, Craig, and that is that I don't think because of the sophistication, and you take a look at the stadiums with the club seating and the enclosed glass seating and everything, it's not like it used to be.
You're exactly right.
And I remember up in Metropolitan Stadium up in Minnesota, where, you know, I mean, you go in there, and I used to have some of the players tell me that were with the Vikings at that time, when they played San Diego or Miami, they always made sure they came out and they warmed up with short sleeve shirts.
Yeah, Bud Grant wouldn't let them wear anything. I mean, they would not have any top coats or anything. And that's one thing that a football player always does, is that when you look at your schedule to be in gear, you look at where you're playing, like in December. You don't want to play in Cleveland,
Green Bay,
Buffalo, or Minnesota. You don't want to play in any of those places because they're the worst. Cleveland may be I don't know. Minnesota's pretty darn cold.
No, Cleveland, you're absolutely right. I remember when the Raiders beat the Cleveland Browns to become the first wild card team to go on and eventually win the Super Bowl. I was there covering that game. Sam Ratigliano was the coach there, and I'll never forget it. Because I was doing some of the play-by-play, and we opened the second half, and I won't tell you who was doing my color because you know him. He's a well-known ball player, and he had a wild guy to say the least. But I said, as we open the second half here, I see it's minus 12 with a wind chill factor of minus 32, and I just left it right there. And I hear click, and he says, "You know, Ronnie, at 32 degrees, your vital parts freeze." I'm thinking, where the hell's he going with it? And he says, at minus 32, they fall off, and your voice is getting a little high. I mean, that was part of the whole feel of professional football back then.
Yes, and the fields were not in good shape. Now it's like it's going to a Hollywood premiere. I mean, every
Showtime.
Yeah, it is Showtime.
Let me ask you about one of your ball players who's one of my all-time favorites, Walt Garrison. Because Walt was a cowboy.
Right, he sure was.
And
Oklahoma
a good
State.
Cowboy.
Great cowboy. That's what he did in the
off-season.
Yeah. He bulldogged.
Yeah.
And let me just see. Walt Garrison's stories. His nickname was Puddin'. Meredith named him Puddin'. So if you can see this big, tough cowboy coming in and everybody, hey, Puddin', what's happening? He used to, when the rookies would come in, he used to have this thing that he did on the rodeo circuit, evidently, is that he'd fill his mouth full of lighter fluid and light a match and blow it out, and it looked like a dragon was coming in. So sure enough, the rookies got the dragon, and I'm telling you, they went through windows. He'd come bursting in and strike that match, and that flame would come out. These rookies would be flying everywhere. Oh my God, oh my God, screaming and yelling. They had no idea what happened. One night he was doing it, and Garrison started laughing, and he struck the match, and his face just goes poof, and it's he just was on. Just a momentary fire. The next day, he had a peel job that lasted a couple of weeks. He didn't do that anymore.
He used to do limericks also.
Yes.
He was on my show, and he did a limerick once that I was on the floor laughing.
And whittle.
Yeah.
He was a big-time whittler. Never tell you his tricks.
Who were some of the other players along your career that you still kind of laugh and smile about when you think about them?
Don Talbert, who was a tackle with the Cowboys, was hilarious. There's Meredith, of course. I mean, I've got hundreds of Meredith stories. Another guy fun to play against was Dick Butkus, because he was he was out of his mind when he was playing. He didn't know who he was. The first thing he'd do when he'd come into the game, he'd go up and spit on the football. So the first thing he did when you went in, just say, please, you know, my center, change the ball because he's going to, you know, Butch's going to spit on it. And boy, was he was mean. He came in the huddle at the end of the game, one game we were playing up there, and we had really thoroughly beaten him. Came in the huddle, and he challenged every guy on that team. He wanted to meet him outside gate 8. And everybody kind of looked down. Nobody was looking up. And he says, "That means you too, Morton. I want you out there." So we go into the locker room to change, and I said, "Hey, where we go? What gate are we going out of?" And the guy said, "We're not going out gate number 8. So they all went around because they thought he was serious. And he might have been out there, but they weren't going to go around that.
One of the things that I love about sports is it lends itself to wonderful stories. And I think the money has probably changed it, that people, you know, the players don't get together like they used to. And I know Willie Mays once lamented the fact that you don't hear stories being told around the batting cage. And I think that has changed it a great deal. Let me switch gears and touch on something that you and I talked about a little bit earlier, the state of the retired ball players. You know, you're a guy, you know, that's been out of the league for a while now. You look like you're walking all right. But generally speaking, give me some insight about how the veteran players, the old players, feel about their state.
It's being so poorly addressed. I've had three knee replacements, maybe 18 knee operations, both shoulders and elbow, foot. But I just feel I can't complain. I mean, as long as I'm doing something, you know, I feel okay. A lot of guys aren't. A lot of guys can't walk. A lot of guys are just. A lot of guys chose the wrong pension plan when we first elected the pension because nobody knew what it was. Guys, they said the first time when we had a chance to elect what option we wanted in the pension plan, a lot of guys, nobody had ever received a pension plan because nobody had ever lived past 55. So everybody just made some bad decisions at first, and they multiplied, and then they just forgot about these guys that really need some help. I think they're addressing it a little bit better now. I think with Ditka's out there with his little group that's helping a lot. George Martin is now the alumni director, president of the Alumni Association. He's, you know, really involved. So I think that they're doing better. But a lot of people, you know, are Medicare, it's like I am. And so it's passing people up. They can't forget about. These guys now have IRAs. They've got everything possible, which I don't begrudge them because – I mean, they're making money. But don't forget the older guys. I mean, these guys that have really, really bad handicaps and bad pensions, it doesn't cost anything to help them guys out at all.
When you take a look or hear or read about what an athlete has just signed for, that he's especially a quarterback, whether you're shaking your head. What do you think?
Just what my head's saying. Well, first of all, it's, how did it ever get to be this out of control? That you'd pay somebody $30-some million guaranteed that's never played a down. And you're not – why wouldn't you do that to the – give that money to the veterans that played? I mean, it's only sensible. Who's competing against you? I mean, when they draft you, nobody's on the other side saying, okay, I'll give you $20 million, I'll give you $30. They're competing against themselves, and just the agents have got them by the toes, you know, and they're ringing them out. So I just I don't agree with it. They will fix it this time. The money ought to be going to the veterans or the older guys that need the money. The rookies do not deserve this kind of money. I mean, I think that they're great talents, but prove it and then make the money. But to Jamarcus just left the Raiders $40 million richer, and he couldn't throw across the street because he's so poorly fundamentally trained. And that's a lot of things that gripe us old quarterbacks, to see these guys come out that are not trained. They haven't played under the center. They're always shotgun. You can't just go from shotgun to playing in the center. And anybody that drafts a quarterback has got to realize it's going to take them a long time to get used to that. It's a whole new game.
Is there a particular memory in your long career that is kind of emblazoned in your mind that either makes you smile or wince a little bit, or that you'll never ever forget about playing professional football?
Well, yeah, the highlights are winning the championship games to go to the Super Bowl, and the one that really sticks out is against the Raiders in 1970. It was January 1st, 1978. I was in the hospital the whole week with a hip pointer that my leg was like 2 inches full of blood, my whole leg. And I never practiced one down that didn't ever get out. And a friend of mine came, picked me up Sunday morning, and I could barely even walk. And he said, "What do you think?" And I said, I don't think I could do this. He said, "You've worked too hard in your life not to give it a try." So it was about 10 degrees out, 15. So I went to the training quarters, got in the hot tub. My leg was just completely black and blue. Made sure all my teammates saw it. lay down there and look for sympathy. Coach came up to me, Coach Miller, he said, are you going to go? And he said, I said, if you could tie my shoes, I'll play. And I said, don't let them hit me, guys, and we'll win the game, and we won it. And I mean, I cried like a baby after that. But that's just something, once again, mentally, it's amazing what you can accomplish.
Craig Morton will always be remembered as an outstanding NFL quarterback who led his teams to the Super Bowl. Finally, I've known Vida Blue for a long time. We met when he was a hard-throwing lefty with the Oakland A's. Blue played with the A's when they won three straight World Series championships in the 70s. He was an MVP and Cy Young Award winner, and he became the first African-American to win the Cy Young. And he was traded by the A's to their Cross Bay rivals, the Giants, for seven players. Blue grew up in Louisiana during an intolerant time and faced the racist attitudes of the Deep South. He also battled the demons of drinking and drugs during his baseball career. It's fair to say his life had many highs and lows, and he wrote about them all in his book called Vida Blue, A Life. A fiercely proud man, I asked Blue what motivated him to write the book.
I was, I met with this young man. He's not a young man, but I'm going to call him a young man. And we had lunch a couple of times, and he said, hey, you mind if I tape this stuff? I said, yeah, go ahead. I don't have nothing to hide. And we just talked baseball and talked about my life. And he put some stuff together, found a publisher, and the rest is history. But it's just a few little tidbits about my life as a player and as a person, Ron, you know.
How would you describe your life?
I can't do it in one word, but, you know, the ups and downs of life and the peaks and valleys of life. And sometimes that's a good mix because it helps build a character in you as a person. You know, if you can take the good, you have to learn to take the bad. You know, and I've had the good, you know, the MVPs and all, and I have the bad. And as I say, you know, I made bad choices, but it doesn't necessarily make me a bad person, you know.
What would your life been like if you hadn't had baseball?
Come on, man. You know, I grew up in Mansfield, Louisiana. And unfortunately, home is home, but Ron, they're about 10 years behind time down there, you know. And I don't know. I'm sure I would have been something else would have motivated me to become something as a productive person, whether it be a fireman, a lawyer. I don't know what I would have done, but luckily for me, I don't have to ponder that because I put all my eggs in one basket and I made it as a baseball player, and the opportunity presented itself, and I was lucky enough to take advantage of it.
You write in the book, in many ways I've had a difficult life, but in other ways I've had a marvelous life with all the struggles, all the pain, mostly self-induced, and all the glory that God saw fit to bring me along with the many times that I fell on my face. I wouldn't have had it any other way.
Because I got back up. Because when I go to the schools and do my volunteer stuff, and I go and talk to the schools and a school assembly, see, I'm not making that stuff up. I can tell them that I experienced that stuff, that I used bad judgment and that. Luckily for me, I'm here standing before you to talk about this, and just think of how many of your classmates or teammates or people in your community, in your neighborhood, who never got that second chance. So that's the beauty of that, that I went through that stuff, used bad judgment, but somehow, some way, as I said, God saw fit for me to come through this stuff and use me as a messenger to go and talk about that stuff. But I think it makes it hits home when you can tell kids, oh, I did that before, you know. Well, come on, who does that anymore? You guys still doing that? You know, I was your age at one time, and I stressed to them. And I think a lot of times when you hear this stuff coming from someone other than your parents or your Uncle Joe, it might make sense. And even as I tell my kids, listen, when you're 16, enjoy being 16. Don't be 19 when you're 16. You'd have to fast forward your life. The world is moving fast enough, man. So enjoy being 16 when you're 16.
In high school, in your senior year, you're a pretty good football player. You threw for 3,400 yards, completed 35 touchdown passes, rushed for 1,600 yards. Also pretty good baseball player, which I'll get to in just a second. How close did you come to making the decision to go football?
Well, this little high school I went to in Louisiana, Ron, half of the faculty was from Southern University, the other predominantly black school in Louisiana, and the other half of the faculty was from Grambling University, Eddie Robinson. And I couldn't make up my mind. It was the biggest decision in my life, you know, number one, to go to college, go to the next level. And number two, I was going to be the original Deion Sanders, because the president of Grambling was President Jones. He was the baseball coach. And I would have gone there had they let me play baseball and football, but they didn't want me to do that. I had to pick one or the other. And In my opinion, Ron, I think I was a pretty decent football player because they growing big in my hometown, man. Our offensive line probably averaged about 250, you know, and that's big for high school. But that's normal in Louisiana and Texas and Florida. Down south, they grow the kids real big. But, you know, my father passed away my senior year in high school, and it gave me a chance to go to my mother and say, listen, if I get drafted, go play baseball, do I have to go to college? Mom, I'm tired of school. But listen, my mom was doing what mothers do and what parents do. She wanted me to go to school to get a degree and you know, would have enhanced my chance to have a better life as an educated person. And I feel totally indebted to her because of that. But my counter was like, listen, if I go start playing baseball, it'll be another source of income. Because my father worked in a steel mill, man. He worked in a steel mill for 20-some years. And, you know, he'd come home and blow his nose. It was like tar black. They didn't have all the health regulations and ventilation stuff going on in this steel mill. But some kind of way, he worked Monday through Friday. He played kind of hard on weekends, but he provided for his six kids and his wife. But, yes, I talked my mom into letting me come out and try this baseball thing, and I got drafted by the A's, and here I am.
In your senior year, you also threw a new no-hitter in high school, and in the seven-inning game, you struck out 21 people.
Now, come on, man. The lights were bad.
Was it not only a no-hitter but a perfect game as well?
No, I think I walked a couple of guys. I threw hard, but I didn't know where the hell it was going sometimes, man. Yeah, and Ron, sometimes, you know, I'm going to have to go back through my bio and really look at some of this stuff and go back to my high school and check some of this stuff, too, because, you know, they have a lot of folklore in Louisiana. They have me walking on water in Louisiana right now, man. And listen, I'm 219. I know I can't walk on water, okay? But it sounds good, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, I do recall a game where I did strike out all the hitters. And no, but it wasn't 21 up, 21 down. There were a couple of walks in between there.
Knowing you as I do and as long as I have and your personality, I'm just wondering how suffocating was it for a young man, a young black man down in Louisiana?
Sure.
And the racism, what was the first time you ever ran into that?
Probably the day I was born. But here's what I do recall as a youngster, as a teenager. You know, your curiosity arises. And hey, Mom, Dad, why can't we go use the city pool? This town, Mansfield, Louisiana, the city pool was off limits to my people. I'm like, but, you know, I'm like, Mom, you pay city taxes. You pay county tax. You pay state tax. You pay federal tax. What's up with this? My grandmother says, listen, son, you don't want to be nowhere where you're not wanted. And that ended that right there. That's why I don't swim today. Who knows? I might have gone down there and taken a swimming lesson. Could have been a black Mark Spitz. I don't know. But and Ron, this is a sad commentary to my hometown. Even today, the parts of the town are segregated. And case in point, the cemeteries are still segregated. You're dead, man. Who cares? You're dead. But yeah, it was an eye opener for me, and you know, imagine what it was like for me to leave home as a youngster, having signed my pro contract. I went to Burlington, Iowa, you know, the Bible Belt of the country, which was it was easy going back there, and I feel lucky that I went there to get broken in about you know the Italian guys on my team that I was going to play with a guy named Vic Scimarelli, and I played with a guy, Polish guy. Oh, God, I had his name and I lost it. I played with some brothers from L.A. I played with a guy named Gilberto Marcano from Venezuela. I played with a guy named Stan Jones, a journeyman pitcher who hurt his arm but was, you know, stuck on. And he was like a big brother to us, to the Afro-American players, and showed us the ropes. He toiled around in A-ball in the Midwest League for about 10 or 12 years. He knew he wasn't going to go to the next level with the Oakland A's. But, yeah, all that stuff is part of the history of Vita Blue's life and some good stuff there along the way. And that stuff, it's etched in my brain. And the next time I do put some stuff in print, I'm going to go dig a little deeper into my past and just put it all out there.
Was that the first time you'd been out of the state?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, probably had gone, well, Mansfield, Louisiana, to the north it borders Arkansas, and to the west it borders Texas, probably about 30 minutes. I can drive and be in Texas. But leaving town for the first time, leaving home for the first time to go do something other than play ball. Yep.
I remember talking to Juan Marichal and Orlando Cepeda and some of the others. They talk about what it was like to leave the Dominican Republic or Puerto Rico or Venezuela, those type of players, and coming to the United States, didn't speak any English, culturally.
I was going to say that. They had the language barrier. And let Orlando Cepeda go to Mississippi. He's considered black in Mississippi. and parts of Louisiana too. And that's just the way it is. I'm not knocking. I'm not trying to belittle Louisiana, the state, or Mississippi. But back in the day, I don't care if you spoke Spanish. You were considered. You were an Afro-American person. You know, they mixed you in with the Afro-Americans. But again, that's a sad commentary to our lives. But look at us now, Ron. It's the year 2012, and things. I'm sorry, 2011. We've made a lot of progress. We have a president that's of color, which means a lot to me. And, I still get to see Willie Mays on a daily basis and Willie McCovey and some of my favorite guys of all time that I get to have interactions with.
We've got Vida Blue in the studio with us. Vida has written a book called Vida Blue, A Life. So you go off to the minor leagues. You're signed by the A's. How did you get signed by the A's, by the way? Were there other teams that were looking at you as well?
No, as far as I'm concerned, I just knew that the Oakland A's were looking at me. You know, interesting story, Ron. Buck O'Neill, who was the first Afro-American scout for the Chicago Cubs, saw me pitch in Mansfield, Louisiana. But the A's were... they had a losing team at that time, and based on the draft, you know, obviously the worst teams draft first. And some kind of way, the area scout in Kansas City was a guy named Ray Swallow, and he came to Louisiana and saw me pitch, and I had a teammate named Jesse Hudson who ended up signing with the New York Mets. My high school, the offensive line coach for my high school negotiated my baseball contract. Can you believe that? So the deal was, he negotiated my contract with Mr. Finley. I agreed and signed the contract. So for the work that he did for Mr. Finley, for keeping me under, I guess, $100,000, he gives my coach two tickets to the 1968 World Series where Detroit and St. Louis mixed it up, and Bob Gibson struck out all those hitters and did his thing. But my high school football coach, offensive line coach, negotiated my baseball contract.
Were you one of those raw bone kids? I mean, tall, didn't have a lot of experience, weren't quite sure what you were doing on the mound when you were throwing the ball?
I was. My baseball pedigree goes back to my grandfather, who toiled around with the Negro Leagues a little bit. He barnstormed a little bit and played some semi-pro ball around northern Louisiana. But all my uncles were athletes. I had an uncle that played, went to Grambling. One was a basketball player. Another one played a basketball. Other uncle played football. And my mother's oldest brother was a big-time baseball player, too. So I was a chip off the old block. But my grandfather introduced me to the game. I sit and listen to him, listen to the Los Angeles Dodgers. And that's how I became intrigued with baseball and this guy named Jackie Robinson. But all my uncles, who are obviously a lot younger, they liked this guy named Willie Mays. So in my grandfather's household, that thing that occurs now, the Giants-Dodger rivalry, was occurring in my grandfather's house back in the early, late 60s late 50s and early 60s. But I remember him listening to the Dodger games and talking about Junior Gilliam and Campanella and Pee Wee Reese and Wes Parker and all these guys. Then, of course, I knew who Sandy Koufax and Don Drysdale were, and those were my people. And Willie Davis and Tommy Davis. And I got a chance to interact with Tommy Davis in 71. He and a guy named Jim Mudcat Grant were on the A's as journeymen, and they kind of showed me the ropes about how to deal with the media and all a lot of the social skills that I picked up, good and bad, that I got them from those guys.
When you only spent 1 year in Iowa in the minor leagues?
Yes, I went single A, double A. I went to Birmingham, Alabama, in the Southern League of all places, where we played in Montgomery, Savannah, Georgia. I met two famous people in Birmingham. Mr. Finley was from Birmingham. I met Paul Bear Bryant. And I also met this guy named George Wallace. I want to tell him so bad. You ever sit in the back of a bus, dude? But I didn't tell him that, Ron. I didn't say that.
1970, you get called up by the A's. Uh-huh. September, right? Tell me about that first game, September the 11th, against Kansas City.
That was the game in which I pitched a one-hitter, I believe.
What?
I think Pat Kelly got the hit.
In the eighth inning?
A left-handed hitter of all persons. Yes. And, I'm just trying to get my feet wet and kind of – it's kind of like an audition. You're auditioning for the job. And I think John McNamara might have still been the manager at that time. But he got fired, and Dick Williams came over from Boston. And, of course, he says, I'm taking the best 25 players north with me when we leave spring training in Mesa, Arizona. And I had joined the reserves, and I had gone to Fort Bragg, North Carolina that winter. So come the 71 season, I was kind of like ready to go. And luckily, that was a spot for me, and I made the team out of spring training.
And 10 days later, you pitch again, and it was against the Minnesota Twins. What happened that day?
There was a guy named Herman Killebrew who I decided to be very careful with after all, I had read his baseball cards. And that, too, ended up being a no-hitter. But I walked Killebrew. I don't know. It might have been this, the third inning or his second at-bat. And I'm thinking to myself, Ron, if I don't pitch this guy very carefully, I could use the game. I could lose the game, the shutout, and the no-hitter all in one swing. So he was better off being at first base. But I think the final score of the game was 6-0.
6-0?
Yeah.
What did you think? I mean, here you are. How old were you when you threw that no-hitter?
I just had turned 20 that July.
And what are you thinking? Second start, I'm thinking, you're throwing a no-hitter?
Ron, you know me. I'm thinking how easy this stuff was that they called the major leagues, you know. I'm thinking, oh, this is a piece of cake. This all it is, you know. But it was a great time for me to kind of put myself on the map, and it meant that I had a – you know, I was a little bit more high profile than other guys on the 40-man roster that going into spring training during the 71 season. I'm sorry.
Were you nervous?
Right, I was too young. I didn't know to be nervous. You know, when you're that young, you don't know to be nervous that people have their high expectations for yourself. You just go out there and do what you do.
Did you throw the ball 100 miles per hour as it was reported?
99.
Yeah, because Pete Rose said of you one time you were the hardest thrower that he had ever faced.
No, he's talking about he faced Nolan Ryan. Pete's very kind. I threw hard, Ron, but I don't know how hard I threw. Luckily for me, I ended up having movement on my pitches, and I think that made me a little bit more effective.
And what about the next year with the Oakland A's? That was a very interesting year, was it not for you?
Yeah, like I said, I had gone to a boot camp. I had gone to a basic training at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. I went. Finished that and went straight to my mom's house about a week, 10 days. I went straight to spring training, and there was no left-handers on the A's roster at that time, at least not to my knowledge. And I just knew that I was ready to go, and I got the opportunity, and I took advantage of it. And it's something that I wish every player could experience, to be at the top of your game like that, like I was in 71. It was like a magical year to be Vita Blue at that time, and it was a fun time for baseball and the Oakland A's and the East Bay itself.
Yeah, 24-8 was the record.
Yes.
Cy Young Award winner, MVP as well.
Thank you.
And also, the thing that jumped out at me when I looked at those numbers was the 24 complete games. Tell me a little bit about the mentality of pitchers at that time when they were pitching about finishing a ball game.
Well, because they didn't have the setup guy at that time. Even though we had a guy named Raleigh Fingers, he would come in and pitch three innings sometime. He didn't come out and just pitch get the last three outs. My pitching coach made us train to pitch nine innings, and that's what I did. And I had in my mind that I was going to go out there and pitch nine innings. I didn't always do that, but my road work in between starts, I did long distance, did sprints and all that stuff that we do, pickups, sit-ups, and all everything else that they made us do. We didn't have a stationary bicycle. You had to run, run, run. And even though the guys said, well, you don't pitch with your legs, but yes, you do. So, my attitude about pitching was, again, Ron, it was like, it's my game, and I'm going to train to pitch nine innings. And we didn't know any better. They didn't have, $45 million invested in us either back at the time. So if we hurt ourselves, it wouldn't have been a big deal. But now, teams are so conscientious of the investment that they have in their star pitchers. And that's why the pitch count came into being itself. But I just think that guys can complete games if they would be allowed to. I really do.
Yeah, it's a mental set. I mean, when you pitched – I think of Bob Gibson. If you tried to take the ball out of Bob Gibson's hand, he would deck you.
He was mad.
He was mad.
Yeah, I've heard stories where, they come out to the mound and say, what do you want? After he said, what do you want with that growl, he was, a Dave Stewart before Dave Stewart was Dave Stewart. And they said, nothing, Bob, just go right ahead. I'll let you finish,
I'm going to ask you about an aspect of your life that not too many people are aware of.
What's that?
1972.
Uh-huh.
You make your acting debut.
with Richard Roundtree.
And Jim Brown was in the movie Black Gun.
Yes, that's very good. That is very good.
What kind of movie was it? What was it?
It was one of those B movies along the line of Superfly and Shaft and all that stuff. And Shaft Comes to Town too, or whatever that thing was. And I had a real crazy scene where I was Roundtree's brother. So we did this at, what's the track in L.A.? Hollywood Park?
Yeah, Hollywood Park.
So I had to spit in this guy's face. I'm like, of all the things I've got to do, could have been jump in a moat or something or have an alligator chase me, but I had to actually spit in this guy's face, which started, the opening scene was me spitting in a guy's face. Then, of course, a stunt double comes in, and I suppose that got my butt beat up and stuff. But we did that 3 or 4 different takes. I'm like, man, I can't. But they had a person that had to wipe the guy's face with a towel and stuff. So, yeah, that was it, Ron. I'm glad I could pitch.
How many lines did you have in the movie?
I don't know. It was something I spit then, you know, you something. You know, something crazy. But it was just that short part. I taped that and flew back to Oakland that same night.
Did you enjoy it? Did the acting bug guy? Because Jim Brown was in that movie.
Yeah. It didn't hit me. I thought I was a baseball player, and I didn't have the wherewithal to think about, you know, this could be something I want to do once I stop playing baseball. But it was a fun time. It was a fun thing to do. But I don't know. I don't even think I would like doing a reality show right now. That'd be tough to do, where somebody's following you around with the camera and videotaping you every movement and every encounter that you have with people that you deal with on a day-to-day basis. I don't know if I could do that.
1972, a very interesting year for you as well with Charlie Finley. First of all, I'm going to ask you about Charlie Finley, your impressions of him the first time you met him, fact and fiction about him.
Oh, he was what he was. He was a self-made person. And, you know, if it wasn't his idea, it was a bad idea. You know, if he didn't think of it, forget about it. And on the other hand, I've got to say he's the guy that should be responsible to get credit for what baseball is today with the uniforms. We had those gold uniforms, the white shoes, everything was color-coded. And look at teams that they have matching shoelaces and caps and sweatbands and mouthpieces and everything else. But he's the guy that started that back in the day when we would travel, the A's would. We would have green tops, gold tops. And, you know, now teams just travel. You go on the road, you have a gray top, and that's what they had then. Now teams have multiple uniforms. But he's the guy to have to give credit for that, and baseball should thank him dearly for that. And, of course, he wanted first base to be green and second base to be blue and third base to be red for TV. He had the insight to see that where this thing was going. And they say he's the guy that talked about night World Series at one time.
Yeah.
So, you know, that grew by leaps and bounds with your TV audience that got home from the 5 o'clock work shift. But he's the guy that started all that stuff, Charlie Finley.
He was a showman.
Yes, he was. The petting zoo he had and at the ball girls.
Was the mule part of it?
The petting zoo in Kansas City, I think the mule was a part of that too, but he flew. I don't know how the mule got here from Kansas City, but the mule was a big part of the day-to-day activities. During batting practice, parents would sit there, look young children on the mule to take photographs of it, and the mules lived at Skyland Ranch and came down in a nice air-conditioned convertible. Not a Volkswagen, a station wagon that was pulling this trailer, had a big OA on the side, had the mule. The mule was a bigger star as Reggie Jackson was.
Now, you guys had a standoff over your contract. How much did you want?
I wanted $100,000.
And how much was he offering?
How much did I get? I got 64 or something. But, Ron, interesting story about that is Mr. Finley knew all the laws and bylaws of baseball. So after we signed the contract, which went on for seemed like ages, we fly to Chicago, and my attorney, I was the first player to have an attorney, have someone to represent him with contract negotiations, and he was offended by that. And I'm like, come on, man, I'm from Mansfield, Louisiana, I'm 21 years old. Who am I to sit down and negotiate with you with a contract? So we go to Chicago at the Drake Hotel. There was Bob Gerst, my attorney, Commissioner Coon, Finley, and his people. So we signed the contract. All is good. I think there was a 13-day strike in 72 with with baseball. So I go to Boston, and I'm throwing in the bullpen, getting ready. So he puts me on the disqualified list, meaning that he didn't have to pay me until the manager, Dick Williams, deemed that I was ready to play baseball. So the $64,000 that I signed, I think he might have taken 10 of it back, maybe 15, because I wasn't ready to play baseball. So he got me on both ways, but we got the job done. And, you know, you're paid for what you did last year. And Mr. Finley, I'd walk in and say, listen, I know you pitched 300-some innings. I know you had 300-some strikeouts. I know you had a 1.2 ERA. I know you had 8 shutouts. I know you had 24 complete games. But I'm not going to pay you, and I don't have to. You're going to take this or leave it. Because the reserve clause was still in effect at the time, and he had me over a barrel. So what was I to do?
How did he put the championship teams together?
Man, the guy was sharp. You know, I would get a phone call at my mom's house, and you always got to identify, Vida, this Mr. Finley. Man, I know your voice. Come on, chill. Listen, what do you think of Don Bailon? I said, man, he's a tough out for me. You think so? Yeah, I like him. Well, guess what? He's your teammate now. I just traded him, Reggie Jackson, to Baltimore. I got Mike Torres and Don Bailon. Don't say nothing. We got a press release on Thursday. I'm like, well, who the hell am I going to tell? I'm in Mansfield, Louisiana. Who wants to know in Mansfield? But some way, somehow, he would get these journeyman players just filling holes here and there. And, you know, I don't know what our team batting averages were over the five-year span in which we won those divisions, but it couldn't have been no more than 250. But, you know, we had one guy, Reggie, that everybody feared in the lineup. But my guy, the most underrated guy, was Joe Rudy. He came to work every day. He was like the blue-collar guy that came to do his job the best of his ability every day. Joe Rudy would get a game-winning hit. Next day, the headlines would say, Reggie says. But some kind of way, Mr. Finley knew talent when he saw it, and he put us together and kept us together. But he kept us so hungry. We were always trying to prove to him that we were worthy of the money that he had paid us. And we were the most underpaid team in the league anyway. So, but we just played ball together as a team. And to win five divisional titles, I'm very proud to be a part of something like that.
And three World Series, too,
back
in the 70s.
Back-to-back, baby. It doesn't get no better than that, Ron.
And that pitching staff, what was it, Blue Moon Odom?
Catfish Hunter.
You.
Ken
and was
Holtzman.
Ken Holtzman.
Yes.
Now, the question I have, knowing that you're a power pitcher,
uh-huh.
How many breaking balls did you and Ken Holtzman throw in your entire career?
Combined. Maybe 200. But we're talking, if we combine both careers, we're talking during their 40 years of baseball.
Yeah. That pitching staff was amazing. What was it that brought them so close together?
Well, because we fed off one another. Mm-hmm. Catfish pitched a two-hit shutout. I want to go out there and pitch a one-hitter, you know? And we had Darryl Knowles. We had a short left. Had Raleigh Fingers. We had a guy named Paul Lindblad, our long left-handed reliever. And we had Glenn Abbott, a kid out of Arkansas, who was our long right-handed reliever. So we had the balanced attack. And Dick Williams, whoever the manager was, could match up with any lineup, you know, with that lefty-righty stuff. And that's what made it work. But we fed off one another. And our leader was Catfish Hunter. He was the greatest guy I'd ever been around. And the first day I met him, he was just a country guy from Hertford, North Carolina. And the last time I saw him, he was a Southern gentleman.
Which did the A's do, fight harder on the field or in the locker room?
The locker room. I can't lie about that. We fought hard in the locker room. But that's what kept us together. And you know how a family can fight amongst themselves?
Mm-hmm.
I can hit my brother, but you can't hit my brother. And that's the way that was. And we defended one another on the field. We had an incident against Kansas City, which was our big rivalry, as well as the White Sox and Angels. But at this time, Kansas City was our biggest rivalry. And, you know, we would fight during the division. And so we had an afternoon game. And I saw this guy a couple of days ago at an A's golf outing named Billy North. So he's pitching, he's facing Doug Bird, and he hits a comebacker to the mound, and Dick Williams said, I don't care if the ball hits back to the pitch, run all the way out to run to the base, because he may have a heart attack, you know. So Billy runs to first base. He turns around and makes a beeline trail, just cold cock Doug Bird, and, of course, we got the 4th-and-1 pilot right there on the pitcher's mound. So they untangle us, the A's and Kansas City Royals players. We go back to the dugout because we were batting. So Bando says, what the hell was that about? What are we fighting for? So North says, he hit me in the head in double-A ball. I told him I was going to get him, and today was the day. I'm like, what? So luckily no one got hurt in that little fisticuff. But again, Ron, baseball players don't fight. Most of us don't. We just push and shove a little bit.
Do you have a particular moment in your career that is kind of emblazoned in your mind that you'll never forget? And that Vita Blue, when he sits back in his own private moment, kind of smiles about?
You know, I think about in 71 when I got a chance to be the starting pitcher in the All-Star game. I thought that was cool. I thought that's something that, I could hang my hat on that one and be satisfied with my career, that I was the starting pitcher in the All-Star game. And just so happened, it was the first time two Afro-American pitchers were the starters in the All-Star game, and that other guy was Doc Ellis, and that's pretty cool.
We got about a minute left. Was writing this book cathartic for you?
No, Ron, it was just something that we did. Like I said, we went to lunch and several different times, and my buddy Marty Friedman started putting stuff on tape. And I said, well, okay, what are you going to do with this stuff now? Well, I have a buddy back east that might want to, and he said, hey, we got to go. I said, yeah, okay, go for it, man. Do help yourself, you know.
Vita Blue overcame great odds to become one of baseball's all-time great pitchers. I hope you've enjoyed U.S. Airways' in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA, and you'll listen to our live broadcast on radio, the American Forces Network worldwide, Sirius XM satellite radio, and the Internet. And if you'd like a listing of Sports Byline USA's radio affiliates, be sure to check our award-winning website. You'll find that at sportsbyline.com. I'm Ron Barr, and thanks for being a part of America's sports talk show, Sports Byline USA.